She saw Felcia's brother walking down the street, not looking at her or anything else. Her fear was cold and deep. Chapter 9. Bajia. Bajia had volunteered for the night shift at the mine. Fewer people to hide from. Less open sky to make him jittery. The work, as backbreaking as it was a relief. The fabricator they'd brought down from the Barbapicola was building tracks and carts as fast as they could load raw material into it. His team was trying to keep up with its output by assembling the rail system that would move ore from the pit to the sifters to the silos. There, it would wait for the Barbapicola's shuttle to take it up into orbit. Everything they'd mined so far had been moved with wheelbarrows by hand. A motorized cart system would increase production by an order of magnitude. So Bajia and his team worked the metal rails, pulling them out of the fabricator, gleaming and new in the harsh white lights. They loaded them on handcarts and dragged them into the mining pit, then unloaded them by hand and welded them into the growing railway system. It was the kind of physical labor people had mostly stopped doing in their mechanized age, and the process of welding inside an atmosphere was totally unlike welding in vacuum, so he had a new skill set to develop. The combination of mental challenge and physical toil left him exhausted. His world narrowed to the next task, the ache in his hands, and the distant promise of sleep. There was no time to dwell on other things. Like being a murderer. Like the corporate security forces sniffing around for him and Coop and the others. Like the guilt he felt every time Lucia lied to them and said she didn't know anything that would help. Later, when he sat in the crew hut with his muscles twitching and cramping with fatigue, trying to sleep with the daylight streaming in through the windows, then he could revisit the death of the shuttle over and over again. Think about what he could have done to disable the explosives faster than he did. How he could have tackled Coop, taken the radio away from him. If his mood was especially bad, he would think about how if he just listened to his wife, none of it would have happened in the first place. On those days, he felt such shame that he hated her a little for it. Then he hated himself for blaming her. The pillow he pressed to his eyes kept the sunlight out, but not the images of the shuttle exploding over and over again, screaming like a dying beast as it went down. But during the night, while he worked, he had some measure of peace. So when Coop appeared at the worksite, sauntering into the pit like he didn't have a care in the world, Bajia almost hit him in the face. "Hey, mate," Coop said. Bajia dropped his hammer, shoulders slumping. "Hey," he said. "So, we got a thing," Coop continued, throwing one companionable arm around Bajia's shoulders. "Need me primero on it." That couldn't be good. "What thing?" Coop guided him away from the worksite, smiling and nodding at the few other night shift crew they passed. Just two chums out for a walk and a conversation. When they were out of earshot of everyone, he said, "Seen that RCE girl going up to the ruins. Sent Jacek to check on it." "Sent Jacek?" Bajia echoed. Coop nodded. "Good kid. Reliable." Bajia stopped, pulling his arm away. "Don't involve my son in this." Before he could get the words out, Coop waved it off and kept talking. "It's important." Coop stepped close, voice lowering. "She went up to the ruins, then went straight to the RCE goons. Jacek says they're planning to wait for us up there. Catch the resistance red-handed." "Then we don't go back," Bajia said. It seemed so simple. No reason to panic. "You crazy, Primo? Toda Ale's been up there. Trace evidence up the ass. They wait long enough, they get bored and bring a real crime scene team down. We all done. All of us, even unless you stop shedding skin when you were there. Well, then what? We go up first. A flare on that blasting powder. Boom. No more evidence. When? Coop laughed. What do you think? Next week sometime? Now, Koyo. Gotta go now. Mediator's landing in hours, not days. Don't want this to be what he sees when he steps off the ship, do you? You a team lead. You can take one of the carts. We gotta get that shit and get gone. Coop snapped his fingers impatiently. Jetzt! Coop spoke about insanity, like blowing up their stash of mining explosives, with such an air of self-assurance and certainty, Bajia found it hard to argue. Sure, blowing up the alien ruins was crazy, but Coop was right. If they found the explosives and traced them back to Bajia, they'd know. He didn't want to, but he had to. So he would. Okay, he said, and walked toward the cart charging station. Only one was left, and because the universe was a cruel and mocking place, it was the same one he'd been driving the night of the bombing. It still had the dents and scorch marks it had picked up that night. The scorch marks everyone in the colony was careful not to ask about. Coop waited impatiently for him to unlock it and back it out of the stall, then hopped in and started tapping out a fast drumbeat on the plastic dashboard. Let's go, let's go, let's go. Bajia went. Halfway to the alien ruins, they came across four more of Coop's inner circle, Pete and Scotty and Kate and Ibrahim. No Zadie. Her little boy had come down with a nasty eye infection and she wasn't around much lately. Kate had a duffel bag she threw into the back of the cart with a metallic thump. Then the four of them climbed in after it. That the stuff? Coop asked, and Kate nodded and slapped the side of the cart to let Bajia know he could drive. Bajia didn't ask what the stuff was. Too late to start questioning. The ruins looked as dark and deserted as they ever did. But Coop made Bajia drive the long way round to come at the site from the side opposite the town. Just to be safe, he said. When Kate pulled open the duffel, Bajia wasn't surprised to see it filled with guns. The Barbapicola hadn't been a warship. They hadn't left Ganymede with a great store of weapons, but what there was had come down to the surface when first landing was begun. This looked like most of them. Kate pulled out a shotgun and started loading fat plastic shells into it. She was a tall, raw-boned woman with a wide jaw and a permanent frown line between her eyes. She looked natural, holding a gun, like a soldier. When Bajia picked one up, a short-barreled automatic pistol of some kind, he felt like a child playing dress-up. You'll need this, killer, Ibrahim said, and tossed him a narrow metallic object. It took Bajia several seconds to realize it was the magazine for his pistol. It only took two tries to slide it in the correct way. Blow the explosives. Clear the site. Destroy the evidence. That had never really been the plan, and somewhere in his gut he'd known. While the rest of the group finished readying their weapons, Bajia stood a few meters from the cart, staring up at the night sky. One of the points of light was the drive tail of the Rocinante, the ship Jim Holden was flying in on. The Mediator. The one who was supposed to keep the colonists and the RCE people from killing each other. He wondered how far out Holden was. He wondered if the man knew he was already too late. Too late for the second time. Holden had been too late on Ganymede, too. Bajia's son, Katoa, hadn't been the only one who was sick, whose immune system had faltered and failed under the thousand different stressors of life outside a gravity well. There had been a group of them who'd come to Dr. Strickland, the man who was supposed to know the answers. Katoa, Tobias, Anna Marie, May. May, who had lived, who James Holden had rescued from the labs on Io. Holden had been there when they found Katoa, too. Bajja had never met the man, had only ever seen him on news broadcasts. But May's father had been a friend. He'd sent a message telling Bajja what had happened, and that he'd been with Holden when they found the boy's body. Why one and not the other? Praxiteke's May, but not his Katoa. Why did some people die and others live? Where was the justice in it? The stars he looked up at didn't have any answers for him. Holden had been too late to stop what was happening on Illis right now, before anyone had ever set foot on it. Before the rings opened, before Venus bloomed. If Katoa were still alive, Bajja wouldn't have come here. And if he had, he wouldn't have stayed. It was a strange thought. Surreal. Bajja tried to picture the man he'd been in that other timeline, and he couldn't. He looked down at the ugly black gun in his hand. I wouldn't be doing this. Game's on, someone said. Bajja turned around. It was Coop. Get back in it, Koyo. Dwi, Bajja said, and took a deep breath. The night air was cold and crisp and tasted vaguely of dirt from that afternoon's dust storm. Dwi. Follow on, Coop said, then headed off to the ruins at a slow trot. Kate and Ibrahim and Pete and Scotty followed, clutching their guns in what they probably thought was a military style. Bajja carried his pistol by the barrel, worried about getting his fingers anywhere near the trigger. They entered the massive alien structure through one of the many openings in its side. Windows, doors, no aliens left to say. Inside, the light coming off their flashlights and work lamps reflected off the smooth, strangely angled walls. The material looked like stone, was smooth as glass, and turned from black to a rosy pink where the light hit it. Bajja trailed his fingers along it. Coop waved for them to stop, then ducked down and crab-walked over to a window-like opening in one wall. He peeked over and dropped back down, motioning for the group to join him. Bajja hunkered down with the rest. See? Coop whispered, pointing at the next room beyond the window. Knew they'd set up there. Kate popped up for a second to look, then crouched down again with a nod. I see five. Reeve, the boss, and four of his goons. Sidearms and stun guns. They're all looking the wrong way. Too easy, boss. Scotty whispered with a grin and clicked off the safety on his rifle. Kate slid open the breech on a shotgun just far enough to make sure there was a shell loaded. Coop held up his big automatic pistol in one hand and yanked back the slide. Then, on his other hand, he raised three fingers and started silently counting down. Bajja looked at each of them in turn. They looked flushed and excited, all except Pete, who stared back at Bajja, his skin looking a sickly green in the pale light and his head shaking back and forth in a silent negation. Bajja could practically hear the man thinking, I don't want to do this. Something shifted in Bajja's mind, and the world seemed to snap into focus with an almost physical sensation. He'd been following Coop in a daze since the moment the man showed up at the worksite, and now they were about to shoot a bunch of RCE security people. Wait, he said. Coop answered by standing up, pointing his pistol into the next room, and firing. Bajja's mind stuttered. Time skipped. Coop, yelling obscenities and firing his pistol over and over into the next room, Bajja is lying on his back on the floor, looking up as shell casings tumble out of Coop's gun and bounce across the ground next to him. They appear to be moving so slow that Bajja can read the manufacturer's stamp. True fire, 7.5 millimeter, they say. Skip. He is standing next to Kate. He has no memory of getting up. She is firing her shotgun, and the sound of it going off in the tight space is deafening. He wonders if he will suffer permanent hearing loss. In the next room, three men and two women in RCE security uniforms are scrambling to take cover, or draw weapons, or return fire. They have looks of panic on their faces. They shout to each other as they move. He doesn't recognize any of the words. One of them fires a pistol, and a bullet slams into the wall near Kate. A piece of the bullet or a piece of the wall punches a small hole in her cheek. She continues to fire, as if the injury is beneath notice. Skip. An RCE security woman clutches at her chest as blood fountains out of it. Her face is pale and terrified. He is just a meter away from her, standing next to Scotty. Scotty shoots her again, this time in the neck. She falls backward in slow motion, hands reaching up to the wound but going limp and lifeless halfway there, and she just looks like she's shrugging. Skip. He stands by himself in a corridor. He doesn't know where it is or how he got there. He hears gunfire behind him and screams. An RCE security man is a few meters ahead of him, holding a stun gun. The man has dark skin and bright green eyes, wide with fear. Baja suddenly remembers that the man's name is Zeb, though he can't remember why he knows that. Zeb throws the stun gun at him and reaches for the pistol he still has in a holster on his hip. The stun gun bounces off Baja's head, opening up a 3-centimeter gash that begins bleeding heavily, but he doesn't feel it. He sees Zeb pulling his pistol, and without thinking about it, he points his own gun at him. He's surprised to see that he's holding it correctly, by the handle, with his finger on the trigger. He doesn't remember doing that. He pulls the trigger. Nothing happens. He's about to pull it a second time when there is a loud bang from behind him, and Zeb begins to fall, blood gushing from his forehead. He waits for the blackout. There was no skipping. No respite. No escape. "Good job," Coop said behind him. "That one almost got away." Baja turned slowly, still in a dream, a fugue, a dissociative state. The impulse to lift his hand one more time, to let the violence carry him just one step farther and shoot Coop, almost lifted his arm. Almost, but not quite. Zeb bled out on the floor. The sounds of gunfire stopped. Behind him, the rest of his group whooped and hollered in happy and excited voices. Baja looked at his gun, remembering how they work in action videos. You put the magazine with the bullets in it in the gun, and then you have to put a bullet in the chamber. He remembered Kate pulling back the breech on her shotgun, Coop pulling back the slide on his automatic. Baja's gun wouldn't have fired no matter how many times he pulled the trigger. Zeb stopped bleeding. That was almost me, Baja thought. But the thought had no emotional content, yet. No weight. It was like a puff of acrid smoke passing through his mind, and then gone again. "Help us drag these bodies out back, Primo," Coop said, patting him on the back. "Zadie's washing the place down with corrosives and digestive enzymes. Kill the evidence. But they ain't gonna eat the big chunks, eh?" Baja helped. It took them several hours to bury the corpses of the five women and men in the hard-packed dirt behind the alien ruins. Coop assured them that the next dust storm would remove all signs that anyone had dug there. The RCE people would just disappear without a trace. Scotty and Pete dragged the rest of their explosives out of the ruins and loaded them on the cart. Then they walked back to town with Kate and Ibrahim. Kate carried her duffel of guns over one shoulder. Baja's pistol was in it again, never having been fired. "We had to do this," Coop said once they'd left. Baja didn't know if he was telling Baja that or himself. Baja nodded anyway. "You set this up. You knew you were going to kill them," and you made me part of it. Coop gave him a belter shrug and a cruel smile. You knew that coming out, Koyo. You maybe pretended not to, but you knew. Never again, Baja said. And if anyone in my family is hurt because of this, I will kill you myself. He drove back to the mine, then walked to his house. The sun was just coming up when he finally stumbled into his tiny bathroom. The man in the mirror didn't look like a killer, but his hands were covered with blood. He started trying to wash them off. Chapter 10. Havelock. About 5 hours before, when Havelock had been halfway through his 10-hour shift, a man dressed in an orange and purple suit so ugly it approached violence sat down on a couch in a video studio on Mars. Havelock floated against his restraints, considering him. Strapping in was second nature now, even though it felt a little silly. The orbital space around New Terra was essentially empty, and the chance of a sudden acceleration was almost nil. It was just a habit. On the little monitor set into the cabin wall, the young man shook the feed host's hand and smiled at the camera. It's been a while since you came by, Mr. Covello, the host said. Thank you so much for coming back. Good to be here, Monica, the man said, nodding like he'd been caught at something. Good to be back. So I got a chance to play the new game, and I have to say it seems like a real departure from your previous work. Yeah, the man said shortly. His jaw was tight. There's been a certain amount of controversy, the host said. Her smile was a little sharper. You want to talk about that? It was physically impossible for Havelock to sink back into his couch, but psychologically, it was a snap. Monica, look, the man in the ugly suit said. What we're exploring here are the consequences of violence. Everybody's looking at that first section, and they don't think about how everything comes after. Havelock's hand terminal chimed. He muted the news feed and took the connection. Havelock, Murtry said, I have a call I need you to take. His voice was so calm and controlled, Havelock felt his breath go shallow. It was the sound of trouble, and his mind clutched at the first fear that came. The Rocinante and Jim Holden, the UN mediator, was about 10 hours from the end of its deceleration burn. Almost here. If something had gone wrong with it... Something happened downstairs, Murtry said. I've got Cassie on the horn, and I need you to keep her from melting down while I talk to the captain. Is it bad? Yeah. Take the call. Be the calm one. You can do that? Sure, boss, Havelock said. Cool as November, smooth as China silk. Good man. The picture froze for a fraction of a second. Then Cassie was looking out at him. For a year and a half, they'd been on the ship together, part of the same team, familiar, if not intimate. He'd been aware vaguely when she'd struck up a romance with Aragao, and then when they'd broken it off. He thought of her as a friend because he didn't think about her much at all. In the image, her skin had an ashy color, and her eyes were lined with red. Cassie? Havelock said, his voice falling into the comforting register he'd trained for in the hostage negotiation workshop he'd taken after the series riots. Here things are a little rough down there. Cassie's laugh shifted the camera, shaking her on the screen like an earthquake. She looked away and then back. They're gone, she said. In the pause afterward, her gaze shifted like she was looking for something. More words to say, maybe. They're gone. Okay, he said. 1,000 different questions pressed forward, wanting to be asked. What happened? Who's missing? What happened? But Murtry hadn't asked him to find out, and Cassie didn't need an interrogator. Murtry's talking to the captain. I know, Cassie said. We had a lead. We found a hideout. Reeve took them out. I stayed back with the witness. Is the witness there? She's sleeping now, Cassie said. I'm a security systems consultant, Havelock. I'm supposed to be figuring out optimal shift schedules and building their surveillance network. I don't shoot people. That's not my fucking pay grade. Havelock smiled, and Cassie smiled with him, a tear leaking out the side of her eye. For a moment, they were both laughing, the horror and the fear transforming into something like exasperation, something a little bit safer. I'm scared as hell, Cassie said. If they come for me, too, I won't be able to stop them. I've got the office locked down, but they could cut through the walls. They could blow the place up. I don't know why we thought it was a good idea to be down here at all. After they blew the heavy shuttle, we should have hauled our butts back up the well and stayed there. We should have dropped rocks on them from fucking orbit. The thing now is keeping you and the witness safe. And how are you going to do that? Cassie asked. Her voice was a challenge, but one that wanted to be answered. You can't, and tell me that you can, all at the same time. We're working on that, Havelock said. I don't even have food in here, Cassie said. It's all at the commissary. I'd kill for a sandwich, I really would, I'd kill for it. Havelock tried to remember what they'd said in the workshop about talking with people who'd been traumatized. There was a list. Four things. The mnemonic was BEST. He couldn't remember what any of the letters stood for. So, he said, I bet you're pretty freaked out right now. I'm not holding it together. Yeah, it feels like that, but actually you're doing good just by not making it worse. That's how people usually get it wrong when things go to hell. Overreact, escalate, all goes pear-shaped. You're holed up and talking to us. Means you've got good instincts for this. You're making that shit up, Cassie said. I'm just this side of going catatonic. Stay on this side and that makes it a win. Seriously, though, you're doing the right thing. Stay cool and we'll get on top of this. I know it feels like it's all going to hell, but you're going to be all right. If I'm not, you will be. But if I'm not, if, right? Okay, Havelock said. If. Do me a favor. There's a guy back on Europa, Piheri Tipini. He's a food engineer. Okay. Tell him I said I was sorry. She thinks she's going to die, Havelock thought. And she may be right. The bright, coppery taste of fear flooded his mouth. The locals were killing RCE security, and she was the last one standing. He didn't know anything about the state of play down there. For all he knew, there might be 3 tons of industrial explosive about to turn Cassie into a memory. Any moment she could die, and he could watch her die, and not be able to do anything about it. You're going to tell him yourself, he said gently, and after this, it won't even be scary. I don't know. You've never met Hihiri. Promise me? Sure, Havelock said. I've got your back on this one. Cassie nodded. Another tear streaked down her cheek. He didn't feel like he was doing a great job of keeping her from meltdown. A tiny inset window appeared on the feed, Murtry's security override. Hey there, Cass, Murtry said. I've talked to Captain Marwick, and we're dropping a team to you. It's going to take us a couple hours, though. Your job is to keep that civilian safe. Cassie's voice trembled when she spoke, but it didn't break. There are 40 of our people on the planet and 200 of them. I'm one person. I can't protect everyone. You don't have to, Murtry said. I've sent the lockdown notice. I'm coordinating the science teams. That's on me. Your job is Dr. Okoye. You just keep her breathing until we're down there, okay?
Yes, sir.
All right, Murtry said. 2 hours. You can do this, Cass.
Yes, sir.
Havelock, we're doing a briefing in the security office right now. If you could pop by.
On my way,
Havelock said. He undid his straps, pulled himself out of his couch, and launched for the hallway. The Edward Israel had corridors that were built as elongated octagons, like something his grandfather would have traveled in. The straps and toe holds along the walls had no directionality. He moved quickly down the hall, his brain flipping from telling him that he was climbing up a massive steel and ceramic well to falling headlong down it to, oddly, crawling upside down, as if he were on the ceiling of a drainage pipe. Belters, he'd been told, had a natural sense of themselves divorced from set ideas of up and down, but he'd only heard that from Belters, and always in the context of how they were better than him. Maybe it was true. Maybe it was an exaggeration. Either way, by the time he pulled himself into the security office, he felt a little woozy and missed the false gravity of thrust. 10 people clung to the walls, all oriented the same way. Men and women with radically different facial structures and skin tones, and all with the same expression. It was almost eerie. Murtry had broken out the riot gear, and the blue-gray body armor with the high neck-protecting collars made them all seem like huge, human-shaped insects. Even Murtry was wearing it, so apparently he was going on the drop too. "I have left," Murtry was saying from his place at the front of the room, "and you're all I have left. The cavalry's not going to come in and save our butts. We are the cavalry, and that means I have already lost everyone I'm going to lose. We are the security team for this whole planet, right here in this room. And we can do it, but not if we're making sacrifices. While we're down there, if you feel threatened, you do whatever it takes to protect yourself and your team. Sir?
Oakme?
Does that mean we have authorization for lethal response?
That means you have authorization for preemptive lethal response, Murtry said,
then waited a moment for the words to sink in. Havelock sighed. It was ugly, but there wasn't a choice. If the heavy shuttle had been just a crime, they could have dealt with it like police. But the locals hadn't stopped there, and now more RCE people were missing or dead. So now, it was more like a war. Well, at least they'd tried the peaceful way first. Not that the Belters would give them any credit for it.
We're dropping in 20 minutes, Murtry said. It's a long, fast drop, and some of it will be choppy. I'm bringing us down just east of the Belter camp. Smith and Way are squad leads. Our first priority is reaching and reinforcing the office down there.
What about the Barbapiccola? Someone asked.
Screw the Barbapiccola, what about the Rosinante?
Murtry lifted his hand, palm out.
Don't any of you spend your time worrying about what's happening up in orbit or back at home. That's on me, and I'll take care of it. Me and Havelock.
Murtry flashed a quick smile at him, and Havelock nodded, almost a little bow.
You have your orders, and you have my trust. Let's get downstairs and get this clusterfuck under control.
The security force broke, bodies moving through the air in a fast, efficient stream toward the hangar and the light shuttles. Havelock felt a thin stab of regret, watching the others head down without him. He remembered something from his childhood, a flash of memory here and gone, about a lame child and the Pied Piper. Murtry floated through the air toward him, moving against the flow.
Havelock, good to see you. I'm going to need a minute.
Yes, sir.
Murtry nodded toward his private office. It was a tiny room, smaller even than a sleeping cabin, with a crash couch on old-style gimbals that arced up and over it. Murtry closed the door behind them.
So, I'm putting you in charge of the ship.
Thank you, sir.
I wouldn't go that far. I'm leaving you in a crap position, Murtry said.
We've got a full crew on the Israel that are mostly eggheads with their petticoats in a bunch because we're not letting them do science, and the captain's been fighting hard to keep them up here. Now there's trouble, they won't be pushing so hard to go down, but the pressure's got to go someplace. I'm leaving you a skeleton crew to deal with it.
We'll get it done, sir.
Good man. The biggest threat we've got on the board is the Rosinante. Used to be Martian military before it went OPA. Israel is huge, but we're a science ship. If the Rosinante knocks us down, we're going down. Why would they shoot us down? Murtry shrugged. I think less about why and more about if. So, there's something I need, and it's going to play hell with your shuttle schedules, but I want you to do it anyway. Of course. We're taking one of the light shuttles for the drop. Murtry said slowly, as if he were thinking it through while he spoke, even though that clearly wasn't the case. The one that's left, I want you to weaponize it. Take off anything that'd keep its reactor from overloading and set it with a hardened remote ignition. Lock out all the standard nav controls and put in something that just you and me have access to. Captain Marwick, too? Murtry's smile was an enigma. Sure, if you want. Give me half a day, I'll get it done, Havelock said. Good. Sir, who are you thinking we'd be using this against? The Belter camp? We're just buying options, Havelock. I hope not to use it at all, Murtry said. But if I decide I'm going to, I want it fast. You'll have it. I feel better knowing that, Murtry said, and put his hand on the desk to push off. Sir? Murtry lifted his eyebrows. Havelock felt a sudden flush of embarrassment and almost didn't go on, and then he did. I know it's a small thing, sir, but when I was on the call, Cassie said she was hungry. I told her we'd bring her a sandwich. Murtry's expression was empty as stone. I was wondering if you could take her a sandwich, sir. Might could manage, Murtry said. And Havelock couldn't tell if the man was amused or annoyed. Maybe both. Havelock floated at his desk. The cells of the brig were all empty. His skeleton crew, the four most junior security staff and a technician they'd borrowed from the ship's maintenance crew, were quietly modifying the one remaining light shuttle, making the bomb. On his monitors, the shuttle drop and the Rosinante's final deceleration burn, and the internal monitors of the station with Cassie and Dr. Okoya, each had their own window. Havelock watched them all, waiting for the next thing to go wrong. Every minute seemed to stretch. The air recycler hummed and clicked. He chewed his thumbnail. When the incoming message chime sounded, he started and had to put his hands to the console to keep from drifting off. He shifted to his message queue. The new one came from the RCE corporate offices on Luna, and the subject was listed as Possible Strategies for De-escalating Conflict on New Terra. Call for input. The timestamp was 5 hours ago. Somewhere out near the ring gates, the radio signals had passed each other. Waves of electromagnetism passing through the void with human meanings coded into them. The distance it had taken a year and a half to travel in person, the message had managed in 5 hours. 5 hours. And still too goddamn slow. Chapter 11. Holden. The Rosinante did the last of its deceleration burn on a tail of white fire and dropped into a high orbit around Illis. Below, the planet looked enough like Earth that the fact that it didn't look like Earth was unsettling. Holden had looked down on alien worlds before. The rust red and white of Mars, the swirls and eddies of Saturn and Jupiter. They were totally unlike Earth's blue and brown and white. But Illis had open sea and sky with puffs of cloud, all the markers that Holden's brain connected with his home world. Except that there was only one large continent, and thousands of islands strung across its one giant ocean like brown beads on a necklace. The mix of alien and familiar made his head hurt. Rosinante, the Edward Israel broadcast at them, why are you target-locking us? Holden slapped at the comm panel until he opened a channel to them. No, that's just standard range finding, Israel. Nothing to worry about.
Roger that.
A not quite convinced voice replied from the other ship.
Alex, Holden said, switching to the internal channel. Please stop poking the bear.
Roger that, Cap,
Alex said, exaggerating his drawl and stifling a laugh.
Just letting the locals know there's a new sheriff in town.
Stop it. Give us an hour for the final check and get us dirtside.
Okie dokie, Alex said. Long time since I landed one of these.
Is it going to be a problem?
Nope.
Holden climbed out of the ops chair and floated to the crew ladder. A few minutes later, he was on the airlock deck with Amos. The mechanic had laid out two suits of their Martian-made light combat armor, a number of rifles and shotguns, and stacks of ammunition and explosives.
What, Holden said, is all this?
You said to gear up for the drop.
I meant like underwear and toothbrushes.
Captain, Amos said, almost hiding his impatience. They're killing each other down there. Half a dozen RCE security vanished into thin air and a heavy lift shuttle got blown up.
Yes, and our job is not to escalate that. Put all this shit away. Sidearms only. Bring clothes and sundries for us, any spare medical supplies for the colony, but that's it.
Later, Amos said, when you're wishing we had this stuff, I'm going to be merciless in my mockery, and then we'll die.
Holden started a snarky reply, then stopped himself. Had anything ever gone the way he planned?
Okay, one rifle each, but disassembled and in a duffel, nothing visible, and light torso armor only. Something we can hide under our clothes.
Captain, Amos said with mock surprise, have you actually learned from your past? Is this a new thing you do now?
Why do I put up with your shit?
Because,
Amos said, starting to strip an assault rifle down to its component parts,
I'm the only one on the ship that can keep the coffee maker running.
I'm off to get underwear and a toothbrush.
The Rosinante would have lit the night sky of Illis during the final part of her deceleration burn. When she landed in a field outside of the colony's ramshackle town, she'd kicked up a dust cloud a kilometer across, and the noise of her descent should have rattled windows twice that far away. So Holden was a little surprised and disappointed when no one was there to greet them. He was the joint OPA and Earth mediator, personally selected by Christian Avasarala of the UN and Fred Johnson, leader of the OPA, as much as the OPA could be led, to oversee the settlement talks. In other places, that would merit a formal greeting by the planetary governor and possibly a marching band. Holden would have settled for a ride into town. He hefted his two heavy bags and started to trudge toward the settlement. Amos carried three. The third was the one he called his everything-has-gone-to-shit bag. Holden sincerely hoped they never had to open it. When they were far enough away, Holden sent the signal to Alex, and the Rosinante blasted off again, kicking up a massive dust storm for a few seconds.
You know, Amos said conversationally, we landed so far from town to avoid blowing dust on the locals and they couldn't even be bothered to send out a cart to pick us up. Seems ungrateful.
Yeah, a little annoyed at that myself. Next time I have Alex land right in the damn town square.
Amos gestured with his head at a massive alien structure rising in the distance. It looked like two thin towers of glass twisted together, like a pair of trees growing beside each other.
So, there's that, he said.
Holden had no reply. It was one thing to read about alien ruins on the location report. It was another thing entirely to see a massive construct built by another species towering over the landscape. How old was it? A couple billion years, if Miller could be believed, on how long the protomolecule masters had been gone. Had humans ever built anything that would last that long? According to the security wonks on the Israel, that's where they think their people were massacred, Holden said after they'd walked together for several minutes.
Oh, good, Amos replied.
Somebody got killed there. That's how we claim stuff, you know. This planet is officially ours now. Other than the admittedly hard-to-ignore alien tower, the rest of the landscape could have been the North American Southwest, hard-panned dirt with small, shrub-like plants. Small creatures scurried away at their approach. For a few moments, they were surrounded by a cloud of biting insects, but after a number of them bit, drank their blood, and dropped dead, the rest seemed to pick up that humans weren't food and lost interest. The colony itself looked like a shanty town. A ramshackle mix of prefab buildings and lean-tos made out of scrap metal and brick. A few were made of mud, so someone had decided to try using adobe. Something about the idea of humans traveling 50,000 light-years and then building houses using 10,000-year-old technology put a smile on Holden's face. Humans were very strange creatures, but sometimes they were also charming. A mob had gathered at the center of town, or, more accurately, at the intersection of the only two dirt roads. 50 or so colonists were facing off with a dozen people in RCE uniforms. They were shouting at each other, though Holden couldn't make out the words. Someone on the edge of the crowd noticed them walking into town and pointed. The arguing died down, and then the entire crowd surged toward Holden and Amos. Holden dropped his bags and waved, smiling. Amos smiled too, though he casually rested his hand on the butt of his pistol. A tall, stocky woman, a few years older than Holden, rushed over to him and grabbed his hands. Holden was almost certain she was Carol Chiwiwi, but if that were true, she'd changed a lot since the picture in his briefing files had been taken. Finally. Now you need to tell these goons. Before she could finish or Holden could respond, the rest of the crowd started shouting at him all at once. Holden could hear snatches of their demands. That he drive off RCE, that he give them food or medicine or money, that he let them sell their lithium, that he prove that the colony had nothing to do with the disappearance of the security officers. As Holden tried to quiet the mob, an older man in an RCE security uniform strolled slowly toward him, the rest of the corporate security people following in a wide V like a flock of geese. Please stop. I'll hear out each and every one of your requests once we get settled in, but we can't do anything if you all yell at Chief Murtry, the RCE man said, moving through the crowd like it wasn't there, sticking his hand out and smiling. Royal Charter Energy, head of Expedition Security. Holden shook his hand. Jim Holden, joint UN-OPA mediator. The crowd hushed and moved away, creating a small circle of calm with Holden and Murtry at its center. Those were your people that disappeared, Holden continued. They got murdered, Murtry corrected him, not losing his smile. The man made Holden think of a shark. All bared teeth and cold black eyes. My understanding is that that was not proven. It's true they cleaned up the scene, but I have no doubt. Until I have no doubt, no punitive action is to be taken, Holden said. He felt Amos move up closer behind him, a silent threat. Murtry's smile didn't reach his eyes. You're the boss. Mediator. Holden said, his tone letting Murtry know that as far as he was concerned, it meant the same thing. Murtry nodded and spat to one side. Sure. The dam broke, and the crowd rushed back in toward them, a tall woman pushing her way to the front. She jabbed her hand at Holden in an angry demand for a handshake. If Murtry had gotten one, she was going to get one too. Carol Chiwiwi, colony coordinator. She said, giving his hand two firm pumps. So that first woman had to have been someone else. Hello, Madam Coordinator, Holden started. This man, she continued, stabbing her fingers at Murtry, is threatening us with martial law. He claims that the Charter gives RCE the right to enforce the laws of the UN Charter and keep the peace, Murtry said, somehow managing to talk over the top of her without raising his voice.
Keep the peace, Carol said. You gave your people a shoot-first directive.
The crowd rumbled in disapproval at this, and the shouting started up again. Holden waved his arms to calm them back down. He hoped it looked more dignified and commanding than it felt. When Murtry spoke, his voice was calm but hard.
I have a hard time seeing how we'd be shooting first. Everybody that's died so far, your people killed. I won't tolerate any further threats against RCE employees or property.
A tall man, with the large cranium of someone raised in the belt, pushed his way to the front.
Sounds like a threat right there, mate.
Coop, please, don't make this worse, Carol said with a resigned sigh.
Ah, Coop is a troublemaker, Holden thought, making a note to remember the face.
Just seems to me, Coop said, turning to look back at the mob with a grin, raising his voice to play to the crowd. Just seems to me that the only one making threats right now is you.
The crowd rumbled encouragement, and Coop grinned from ear to ear, enjoying the power that came from giving the mob a voice. Murtry nodded at him, still smiling.
There isn't anything I won't do to protect the lives of my team, that's true. And we've lost too many already to take further chances. Hey, don't blame us, mate, if you can't keep track of your people.
Someone in the crowd laughed.
Don't worry, Murtry said.
His smile still didn't change, but he stepped in close to Coop.
I'll find out what happened to them.
Maybe you should be careful,
Coop said, looking down at the shorter man, his grin turning feral.
Or, you know, it might happen to you too.
That, Murtry said, drawing his gun, was definitely a threat.
He shot Coop in the right eye. The belter man went limp and dropped like a machine that had been unplugged. Holden's own gun was in his hand and pointed at Murtry even before he fully processed what had just happened. Amos stepped up next to him, his pistol trained on the RCE security chief. The entire RCE team pulled weapons and aimed them back at Holden. The crowd was deathly silent.
What the hell? Holden said. I just said no punitive action. I mean, I just said that.
You did.
That wasn't punitive action.
It was a response to a direct verbal threat. Murtry put his pistol away and turned back to Holden.
We've established martial law here, under Article 71 of the UN Charter for Exploration of this World. Any threat to RCE personnel will be dealt with swiftly and with prejudice.
He stared at Holden for several long seconds, then said,
Might should put your gun away, Captain.
Amos took a half step forward, but Holden put a hand on his arm. Put it away, Amos. He holstered his own gun, and a second later, the RCE team did the same.
I'm glad we could establish this working rapport so quickly.
I'd recommend you get settled in, Murtry said.
I'll come by for a visit later.
The coordinator had set aside rooms for Holden and Amos in the large, boxy prefab warehouse structure that had been converted into a combination of general store, commissary, and pub. The rooms in back were furnished with a cot, a table, and a water basin for washing.
They gave us the presidential suite, I see, Amos said, dumping his bags on the floor of his tiny room. I need a drink.
Give me a second, Holden said, then went into his own room and called up to the Rocinante. He delivered a full report of the landing and the shooting of Coop. Naomi promised to beam it back to Fred and Avasarala for him and told him to be careful. The bar, such as it was, consisted of four shaky card tables and 20 or so chairs scattered near the commissary corner of the building. Amos was waiting with two bottles of beer when Holden finished up his report.
That went well? You get the feeling we may be in over our heads here?
Amos asked, after a few companionable sips of beer.
Feels about normal to me, Holden replied.
Yep.
They were on their second beer each when Murtry arrived. He talked to the bartender for a minute, then sat down across from Holden and put a bottle of whiskey and three glasses on the table.
Have a drink with me, Captain, he said, pouring out three shots.
You're going to go to prison for what you did today, Holden said, then tossed back his shot. The whiskey had the sour, moldy taste of Belter distillations.
I plan to make sure of that.
Murtry shrugged.
Maybe.
My plan is to make sure all my people survive long enough for prison to be an issue. I've lost almost 20 now, between the attack on the shuttle and the murder of my ground team. I won't lose any more.
You're a corporate security detail. You don't get to declare martial law and shoot people who don't cooperate. I wouldn't put up with that from legitimate governments, much less a rent-a-cop like you.
Holden poured himself another drink and sipped at it.
What's the name of this planet?
What?
The planet. What's its name?
Holden leaned forward, the word Illis on his lips. He paused. Murtry's smile was thin.
You've spent a lot of time working for the OPA, Captain Holden. And you're on record as harboring a deep-seated dislike of the kind of business that employs me. I have some reservations about your ability to address the situation here in an unbiased manner. Threatening me and calling me names doesn't do much to reassure me.
You undermined my authority by killing a Belter within 5 minutes of my arrival, Holden said.
I did. And I understand that could make you feel that I'm not taking your role here seriously. But your friends in the UN are a year and a half away, Murtry said. Think about that. It takes between 8 and 11 hours to have the first 2 exchanges of a conversation and almost 19 months to get here from there at civilian speeds. Our local governor has been murdered by terrorists. My people have been killed for trying to enforce our legal rights. Do you honestly think I'm going to wait for you to fix what's wrong here? No. I'll shoot everyone who threatens the RCE expedition or its employees, and I'll sleep well afterward. That's the reality of where you are now. Better get used to it.
I know who you are, Amos said.
The big man had been so quiet that both Murtry and Holden started with surprise.
Who am I?
Murtry asked, playing along.
A killer, Amos said.
His face was expressionless, his tone light.
You've got a nifty excuse and the shiny badge to make you seem right, but that's not what this is about. You got off on smoking that guy in front of everyone. You can't wait to do it again.
Is that right? Murtry asked.
Yeah. So, one killer to another. You don't want to try that shit with us.
Amos, easy, Holden warned. But the other two men ignored him.
That sounded like a threat, Murtry said.
Oh, it really was,
Amos replied with a grin. Holden realized both men had their hands below the table.
Hey now, I think maybe one of us is going to end bloody, Murtry said.
How about now?
Amos replied with a shrug.
I'm free now. We can just skip all the middle part.
Murtry and Amos smiled at each other across the table for an endless moment while Holden ran through contingencies in his mind. What if Amos gets shot? What if Murtry gets shot? What if I get shot?
You fellas have a nice day, Murtry said, standing slowly.
His hand was not on his gun.
Keep the bottle.
Thanks,
Amos replied, pouring another drink. Murtry nodded at them, then walked out of the bar. Holden let out an exhalation that he'd been holding for what seemed like an hour.
Yeah, I think we are in way over our heads here, he admitted.
I'm gonna need to shoot that guy at some point,
Amos said, then tossed back another shot.
I wish you wouldn't,
This is already looking like a train wreck, and in addition to chewing up a few hundred colonists and scientists, which is bad enough, it will also be